This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate. Then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Micah Loewinger.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. So, over the course of a century of what Naomi Oreskes exposed in the previous segment as free market propaganda, there have been periodic spasms of resistance, efforts of the disaffected to rouse themselves from the fever dream. And often, the instrument of that arousal is yet another doctrine, another piece of propaganda, even older than the one it seeks to displace.
On college campuses, a Communist Manifesto is one of the most frequently assigned texts.
Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels' Slender volume appeared in 1848. For many of those betrayed by the so-called free market in the years since, the pamphlet has offered refuge, inspiration, and argument. So many arguments still.
In 2012, The Guardian reported on Marx's growing influence and popularity across Western Europe, noting the continued rise in book sales and the incredibly ironic fact that a bank in Germany issued a credit card with Marx's image.
Like Hamlet's ghost, the manifesto is both impossible and imperative in its call for action.
Joe Biden, where he's gone. He signed on to Bernie Sanders' crazy 110-page Communist Manifesto that will absolutely destroy America. $4 trillion in new taxes, a Green New Deal.
China Mieville writes stunning speculative fiction, but his latest book, A Specter Haunting on the Communist Manifesto, is a nonfiction rumination on that stalwart text, its place in the world, and how best to read it today. Welcome to the show, China.
Thank you so much for having me.
One of the few gripes I think you have with the book is that its authors are rather too admiring of the bourgeoisie. One of its most famous passages goes, "Everlasting disturbance and agitation distinguish the bourgeois epoch from all earlier ones. All fixed, fast-frozen relations with their train of ancient and venerable prejudices and opinions are swept away. All new-formed ones become antiquated before they can ossify. All that is solid melts into air. All that is holy is profaned. And man is at last compelled to face with his sober senses his real conditions of life and his relations with his kind."
It is often a surprise to the newcomer to the manifesto quite how much praise they heap on the bourgeoisie. It became very quickly evident in the revolutions of 1848 that much of the bourgeoisie of Europe was more afraid of the working class than it was of the ancien régime. Across Europe, the middle class made their peace with these old reactionary powers, and there was a period of immense reaction through the 1850s. If they had written the pamphlet even a year later, I think it would have had a much darker and more pessimistic tone.
Let's talk a little more about the text then. It is stirring. It scans. Some of its critics call that a weakness.
The argument is because this is written in such a style, that is almost evidence in and of itself that its arguments don't hold up, is straightforwardly absurd. And one of the things that has frustrated me a lot, one of the main reasons I wrote the book, is the lack of curiosity among a lot of its critics about the nature of the manifesto form itself. There is a notorious bit in which the manifesto says the working class has no country. This is often read as saying that the working class movement has to be internationalist, which is right, and that Marx and Engels grossly underestimate the power of nationalism. There is an element of truth to that. I think they were too sanguine about how powerful nationalism was. But what they are doing in that moment is grabbing the working class by the lapel and shaking them and saying, stop identifying with your countries. You have to be an internationalist. That's the nature of that sentence. And if you cannot, in good faith, engage with the way that the substance and the style are working together, and that sometimes a claim in the book is a prophecy or is a plea or is an entreaty or is an encouragement. If you can't seriously engage with that, you will never understand what kind of book this is.
It is exhortation, prediction, assessment.
Exactly.
Let's tick off the three most prevalent arguments made by critics of the manifesto. The first is something called capitalist realism, the notion that it really can't be any other way.
Exactly. This is a term that was coined by Mark Fisher, a very brilliant cultural critic. And the interesting thing about capitalist realism is that all it requires is to disseminate the idea that nothing can be done. Therefore, even if you think that this is a terrible system, there's no point fighting against it. And this has never been more clearly put than with Margaret Thatcher's notorious and famous phrase that there is no alternative.
Tina.
Exactly. We all call it Tina. That is the most pure propagandistic expression. Mm-hmm. It's absolutely vacuous and empty. Ursula Le Guin, the great writer, has a beautiful formulation about capitalism, that its power seems inescapable, but then so did the divine right of kings.
On to the next argument, human nature. With regard to the manifesto, you quote biologist E.O. Wilson writing, it's a lovely theory, wrong species. In other words, it can't work because human nature is just too base. I've changed my view of human nature from thinking it'll always go low to a belief that it's more plastic. It can be manipulated to dwell with the devils or respond to its better angels.
Conservatives often accuse socialists of having a dewy-eyed view of human nature, but to have a sense of the potential for a radical reconfiguring of the everyday. You don't need to believe that people dwell with the angels. All you need to believe is that whether people dwell with the angels or the devils depends on an awful lot of complicated circumstances. Capitalism is a system that quite explicitly rewards selfishness. It's hardly a surprise that precisely that kind of dog-eat-dog behavior is very often valorized and very often the way people live, in some cases because they have to. Mm-hmm. We know that people behave incredibly differently throughout history and throughout different societies.
How about the last criticism of the manifesto? In one word, Stalin.
It marshals the existence of the Stalinist regimes against communism, both because they were awful and not sustainable. I completely agree. But the problem is, if you were to only listen to them, you would not know that there have literally for over 100 years been very serious debates within Marxism, within the left, precisely criticizing those regimes, not just that these are not desirable and not sustainable, but that they are also not in any meaningful way communism. If you look at Marx and Engels's writing, this is why these regimes cannot be considered legitimate representations of this political program. And I want to be very clear about this. I'm not saying you have to agree with that, but to simply act as if the mere fact that there were these unpleasant regimes that called themselves communist is therefore evidence that communism is doomed, and to have no curiosity about the internal debate, again, it's just not serious. That idea that Stalinism disproves communism rings very hollow if you are someone who has spent a long time reading the communist critiques of Stalinism.
You quote Marshall Berman, the late great humanist, modernist, Marxist, who observed that whenever there's trouble anywhere in the world, the book becomes an item. It provides music for their dreams.
And this really kicked off after 1871 with the Paris Commune. And then, of course, it exploded again after 1917 with the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia. And for the first time, you had this powerful nation identifying with the communist project. And that led to interest and also a plethora of cheap editions, the Soviet Union turning it out in various translations. Even in 2008, 2009, when the great financial crash occurred, it was reported, often with a kind of wry amusement in the business press, that sales of the Communist Manifesto had spiked. I actually find it incredibly poignant and incredibly moving that in this moment in which, for a lot of people, their retirement funds, their life plans have been destroyed, that one of the things that happened in that moment is this yearning sense of surely there has to be a better way of organizing things than this. I think that ebb and flow of interest is something that we are going to continue to see.
You also observed that in the aftermath of 2008 and in the rise of social media, you had a very strong right and a much weaker but more vocally unbound left that punched above its weight. And the result was the right starts to hallucinate enemies.
Yes, the right has always hallucinated enemies. A friend of mine, the writer Richard Seymour, has called this the era of anti-communism without communism. And yet you still have supposedly mainstream American politicians denouncing Obama and Biden as communists. This is so absurd that you have to understand it as a kind of lazy sloganeering and as a kind of fever dream. I like to hope that overblown, febrile attack might actually encourage a certain degree of curiosity about what this bogeyman is. And particularly because, although on a much smaller scale, you have various young leftists, even though their numbers are not particularly big, talking about communism in that online way, which is like somewhere between a joke and a provocation. It's very unstable, but as you said, it punches above its weight. And when that's happening in the context of a generationally unprecedented upsurge of interest in socialism and the left in Britain and in the US, the explosion of membership of the Democratic Socialists of America and Bernie Sanders' campaign and Corbyn in the UK, there is, I think, a real good faith fascination with these radical traditions.
You've observed that there's a sense in which every generation reads it anew and that certain things come up quite sharply. What's coming up now?
The planetary crisis. That famous phrase, you have nothing to lose but your chains and we have a world to win. The fact is that the world that we have to win is deeply wounded. So even were capitalism to be done away with tomorrow, how do we salvage and repair a livable world? So even a radical program has, I think, to approach that with a serious sense of humility. Secondly, I think the rise of an iteration of the far right of terrifying strength and a particular kind of overt sadism provides a very strong sense of the dangers facing us. I think they are, in fact, inevitable excrescences of a system predicated on profit over need, built on the bones of a system of patriarchy and white supremacy and so on. If you see this new sadistic hard right as an inevitable feature of capitalism, then the stakes of moving beyond capitalism become ever more urgent.
You wrote at the end of your introduction that a specter haunts your text, a hunch that, in fact, the manifesto now looms more than ever. I'd suggest the enforced isolation of the recent lockdowns that enabled us to look through our computer screens at the world and to think more in terms of systems. You make a very persuasive case that the totality of capitalism, it's not just an economic system, but one with its own philosophy, principles, worldview, culture, everything, is very hard to dislodge. But I don't think it's seen now through a glass quite so darkly.
I think you're right, and I hope you're right. One of the things that is interesting as capitalism enters this doddering and dangerous phase is that it has spent so long saying that there is no alternative and so on, that when it is forced to do things that it said for decades it couldn't do, like this enormous influx of public funds into furlough schemes during the pandemic, having said it couldn't possibly do that, it starts to make people think, well, if it's not true that that couldn't be done, what else couldn't be done? American business for decades said universal health care is impossible. It's not a question of whether or not we want it. It cannot be set up. If that demand becomes loud enough that people at the top start to feel that continuing to deny it will put their position in jeopardy, you can absolutely bet your bottom dollar they will grudgingly allow a universal health care system. And the point is, all these things that they say are impossible are not impossible. What they are is not desired by capital.
But capitalism, as you note, is enormously adaptable.
It is incredibly adaptable.
Something not anticipated by Marx and Engels.
No, indeed. And this is one of the things that I think they got wrong. They underestimated the extent to which it can accommodate certain reforms as a way to continue. The manifesto and the tradition have to be read today with a much sharper sense of how adaptable capitalism is. Now, I do think that that flexibility is diminishing as it becomes more and more shaky. And these moments of outright sadistic hard right are symptoms of that shakiness.
People of goodwill are frightened by violence and by hate, which can spread so quickly out of control. These aren't intellectual arguments against revolution, but visceral ones. In your book, you build up to a discussion of the utility, the necessity even, of hate.
I had a debate with a friend. She basically said to me that she always felt uncomfortable when I talked about hating capitalism. And I understand that. But all I can say is, I look at the cruelty and the waste and the violence and the sadism. Who would I be ethically not to hate this system? If that hatred is one of the things that can help us to be motivated to overthrow this system of iniquity, surely that is hate in the service of love.
Overthrow how?
People think that they are fundamentally opposed to the use of force in any situation, but actually very, very few people are. Do we really think that the fighting of slaves on a slave ship or the activists in the Warsaw Ghetto was not justified? So the question then becomes, if you think like me that this is a world built on oppression, exploitation, racism, homophobia, sexism, then it becomes an ethical urgency to see its end. And one of the reasons that I think it's so important to build socialism as a mass movement is that the more people who simply say, we deserve better than this, the less likely any kind of coercion or force becomes necessary. I'm not interested in 100 people with guns saying, right, we now have socialism. There's no point at all. But I am interested in the mass of people simply turning around and saying, we will no longer be treated like this by this system. Overthrow for me is the point at which the majority of people simply say, no more.
So that could happen by the system adapting itself to the point where it is no longer that system.
I'm not interested in reforms of trying to make capitalism a little bit better. I mean, don't get me wrong, I'll take them if they come along because I'm not indifferent to life being better for people along the way. But any reform within the context of a system that is fundamentally about prioritizing profit over human need will always be embattled and endangered. You know, you say overthrow how, change how. The point is, I don't have a blueprint. People do sometimes imply if you can't lay out a point-by-point planned alternative, somehow your demand for a change is illegitimate. I think that's just complete nonsense. You look throughout history, whole social situations have been overthrown and changed because a critical mass of people could no longer live with the world the way it was.
Tell me, what did you want to accomplish with this book?
I want this book to be an introduction to the manifesto for the curious reader to actually find out what this notorious document is all about. I want to talk to the critics of the manifesto and to say, by all means, let's actually have a serious debate. But one of the starting points for that is you are going to have to acknowledge that most of the stuff you say about this text is embarrassingly weak. And if you want to be taken seriously, bring your A game instead of this D game you've been bringing for decades.
China, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
China Mieville is the author of A Specter Haunting on the Communist Manifesto. And that's the show, co-hosted this week by OTM correspondent Michael Loewinger. On the Media is produced by Eloise Blondio, Molly Schwartz, Rebecca Clark Callender, Candace Wong, and Suzanne Gaver, with help from Tammy George. Our technical directors, Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Andrew Nerviano and Mike Kutchman. Katya Rogers is our executive producer. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.